once more under the breach, dear friends. Else fill up the wall with their English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting, and truly exciting this time, episode of The Personal Wealth Coach on this Saturday, June 11th, 2016. It's exciting because I, Jeff McClure, am here all by myself. Jake is wandering around somewhere in Florida at this point. And that means over the next 2 hours, I will have the ability to say something really stupid and regret it for the rest of my life. And that is always one of those things that is exciting. And so I am challenged today by the need to speak to a sort of green and brown foam ball for the next 2 hours and sound interesting. So if you would like to assist me by asking questions, making comments, or in any way enlivening my otherwise gradually decaying brain, you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here. The area code is 254, and it's 947. I'm sorry, I'm about to give my office number. It's 254-773-1400. See, I'm so used to saying 947-1111, which is our office number, that I almost said that. But it's 254-773-1400 is the number to call in here. And I need to do a disclosure. The disclosure is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not merely a radio program. I used to call it a radio show, but Jake corrected me a long time ago and said, since there's nothing to show because it's sound, it has to be something other than a show. And he suggested a tell, but that has to do with gambling, and we don't do that, so let's call it a radio program. Anyway, it's not only a radio program, it's also the name of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, because it just simply means we're large enough that we have to do that rather than the state. And that's the disclosure. And so there it is. And again, the telephone number is 254-773-1400. So, since this is the Personal Wealth Coach, one of the things we obviously want to talk about is we start off with what the markets did during the week. And I like the headline in Barron's. The Dow rises 0.3%, S&P stays flat, which could have been last week's headline as easily as this week's headline. The fact is that the Dow Jones Industrial Average went up less a third of a percent. The S&P 500 was flat, and we can say pretty much the same thing about last week. For the year, for 12 months, the S&P 500 is up about 2.5%. I mean, year to date, it's up about 2.5%, and for the 52-week period, it's up 0.09%. Now that means next to nothing, because the return is next to nothing. And if you've been invested for the last couple of years, your return too probably has been next to nothing. It's one of those things that is really, really hard to get our minds around. Historically, and over long-term periods, stocks in the United States, measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 or its predecessors, going back 150 years or so, have averaged about a 7% growth per year. And that's a pretty reasonable growth. It's during good periods, during bad periods. If we throw in the dividends, that growth rises even a little further. And it's really something that we have come to accept as a matter of faith. And those of us who were invested in the market in the 80s and 90s certainly saw a higher rate of growth than that. But since then, it's been pretty anemic. Of course, on the other side, bonds historically have returned 3-4% a year. And again, that is that's one of those things that people kind of accepted as being an historic norm. And this is the point I want to make. It still is. The problem that we're running into right now is long-term averages can be very, very deceiving. I say very deceiving in the sense that we don't normally think long term. We normally think year to year. And for the past couple of years, with the S&P 500 and the stock market flat, why is one of the big questions. And the second one is, where are people going with their money if they're not investing in the stock market? And the answer pretty much is consistent. They've been going to bonds. Why have they been going to bonds? They've been going to bonds because they're afraid. And in the process of putting, and I say people, nations as well, there's been a phenomenal quantity of investment. And I say historically, as a percentage of all the money invested, a phenomenal quantity of that money as a percentage has gone into bonds, and particularly the least risky of bonds. And those bonds are normally the very high-rated corporate bonds, AAA-rated. But even there, there's been not as much investment as there's been in government bonds. Why do people buy government bonds? Because generally speaking, governments can print their own money. They will pay you back. Particularly the United States, and it is assumed countries like Germany and Japan will pay back their debts. And that's a good assumption, and it's very real, and it's very reasonable. But the result of buying a lot of any asset is that the price goes up. That's the immutable law of supply and demand. Back in the 1990s, bonds were pretty unpopular. Stocks were extremely popular. We saw typically double-digit growth per year, 12% to as high as 24% in the S&P 500, beginning in about 1994 and running through 2000. We're seeing the other side of that coin now. Had you invested, now if you want, and again, this is a little esoteric, but it's important to remember that some of the biggest money out there is pretty sophisticated. Had you invested a year ago, and you would have to be very sophisticated to do this, in long-term Japanese bonds, then you would have seen, depending on which ones you did, hold on just a moment. Yes, that was a door closing. You would have heard... You would have observed that your investment grew in the last year anywhere from on the low end 12% to the high end 23%. There's even a, if you timed the investment perfectly in, you needed large scale investment in Japanese long term government bonds, you could have gotten a 47% return in the last year. You could have done not quite as well, but still a double-digit return in German bonds in the last year, long-term bonds, or in British bonds over the last year. You actually had a pretty decent return in United States long-term bonds over the last year. United States Treasury bonds, you would have gotten about somewhere between, depending on your timing and a whole series of things, 8 and 12% price return in those bonds over the last year. Now, this is a really important thing. The long-term United States Treasury, 30-year Treasury, is paying about 1.76% right now. So how in the world do you get an 8 or 10%, if you're absolutely perfect in your timing, return out of a bond that's paying 1-point-something percent? And the answer is, you invest in it when it's low and you sell it when it's high. And this is one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about bonds, is their price is exactly the opposite of the interest rate. In other words, if interest rates drop, the market price of bonds, all other things being equal, goes up. If interest rates rise, the price of the bond goes down. It's really a fairly simple process. And one of the areas where people think there is no risk is in long-term treasuries. As a matter of fact, over the last 30 years, they've been one of the better places to invest. Why? Because interest rates have been falling for 30 years. Here's what's one of the a couple of the big issues that are going on in the big wide world today. There's a lot of fear, and when people are afraid, they gravitate towards what they believe to be certainty. They believe to be safety. In many cases, that very move to safety can be extremely hazardous to their future well-being. It's rather like a lot of people on a boat, and something happens on one side of the boat that causes them to be afraid, and they all go to the other side of the boat, and the boat capsizes. So a similar effect happens in the markets. What's happened over the last couple of years is a rising rate of fear. Now, what are we afraid of? Well, we're afraid of terrorism. We're afraid that China is going to collapse. That's probably one of the main fears that's driving some of the more sophisticated investors right now is a fear that China is going to collapse. And the mere fact that I said that might make you afraid that China is going to collapse. Fact is, the chances are very, very, very high that Chinese economy will not collapse. Why will it not collapse? Because there is a very wealthy central government that has a lock on that economy and is very capable of pumping it up if they want to, and they have the money to do it. Yes, a person could argue that over an extended period of time in a free economy, the financial behavior of the Chinese government probably would not be sustainable. It's not a free economy. The public markets there are a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the economy. And the government is quite capable of stepping in and taking control of just about anything it wants to, and it has the money to handle it. Now, it could be that if you're an investor in China, that could be very painful to you. But I don't recommend you invest in China, so that kind of solves that problem. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, enjoy the show. Enjoyed the newsletter yesterday. I have
Thank
a question.
You.
Now, some of the talking heads are saying, you know, China's got so much U.S. Debt that all they have to do is threaten to sell it, and that'll collapse the economy. But anyway, my question is there any controls by whoever, the Fed or whatever, to limit the amount of U.S. debt that non-U.S. citizens or companies or banks can purchase? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, thank you for calling. The answer to you made two comments. One, people are saying that all the Chinese have to do is threaten to sell off U.S. debt that they own, dollar-denominated debt, treasuries, and they could collapse our economy. And the second thing that you raised, a good question, is there any control over how much debt is owned outside of the United States of the United States debt? And the answer to the second one, I'll answer first, because very simply, yes. Every time the Treasury has an auction for U.S. debt, Treasury bonds, there is an allocation in that auction. And the Chinese typically have between $6 and $12 pledged to buy U.S. Treasury notes, bonds, bills, whatever we are offering that in that particular auction, for every dollar that they're going to get to buy. They typically have more money available to buy at an auction than there are Treasury securities available to sell. But the vast majority, and I do mean very vast majority, of U.S. Treasury securities at each auction go to U.S. institutions, and a smaller percentage go to members of the public. The largest single holder of U.S. Treasury debt right now is the United States Federal Reserve, which I think I can say with a great deal of confidence is not likely to dump it onto the open market, particularly as they make a lot of money off of them. Yes, the Chinese have a significant quantity of U.S. debt, and I want to just tell you something that is very profound that a lot of people don't like to hear. Their large-scale holdings of U.S. Treasury securities is the only reason they can effectively do business outside of China. I want to say that again. the only way that the Chinese industry and government can do business with the rest of the world is because the rest of the world is confident that the Chinese currency is backed by a large quantity of dollar-denominated debt. And I'll go into that in a little more detail. When the Chinese are net importers right now rather than net exporters, they import the vast, vast majority of the raw materials they use to make everything. They have to buy those raw materials someplace else, and very frankly, in the rest of the world, the yuan, or renminbi, as it's sometimes, they're two meanings, they're two words that mean the same thing, pretty much. They mean the Chinese currency, are not spendable in the rest of the world. The Chinese currency, simply, you can't go anywhere in Africa or Europe with Chinese currency in your hand and buy anything. First off, people can't figure out what it means or how much it's worth or anything else because it varies. Secondly, the Chinese don't want you to. They don't want their currency freely traded because they don't want to be subject to the currency markets. So what does the Chinese use if they want to buy a million tons of iron ore out of Africa? They use dollars. And it is absolutely vital to the Chinese economy and to the survival of the Chinese government that the dollar remain healthy. As a matter of fact, one of the fears that has been floating around, and it's a strange fear, is that the Chinese will devalue their currency against the dollar. Now, why would that be a bad thing? Well, first off, if you're invested in China, and you have, and a lot of very the more wealthy institutional investors, for example, count the money in millions and sometimes in billions that they have invested in China. And I'm going to use an extreme example. Let's say the Chinese stepped out and said, we're devaluing our currency. We're going to drop the price of our currency against the dollar by 10%. You just lost 10% of your investment. You just lost $100,000 on your million-dollar investment. And it's really hard to make that up, and that would make people very, very unhappy, obviously, to lose all that money very quickly because their investment is measured in the Chinese currency, the yuan. Now, has the Chinese currency devalued slightly against the dollar? Yes, but it's not because they are running the price down against the dollar. It's just that the dollar has risen in value over the last couple of years. It's pretty much stabilized at this point. It has had a negative effect on our balance of trade, on our trade deficit, which is meaningless. And I can explain that in detail if you're interested, why our trade deficit is pretty much meaningless at this level. But the point is that the Chinese and the United States are interdependent. We make a lot of noise and both sides like to rattle sabers a little bit and demonize the other side a little bit. And the Chinese are particularly adept at turning us into the bad guys and talking about how they could defeat us. The fact is that if the United States were to suffer anything even vaguely catastrophic economically, the Chinese economy would collapse. Why? Well, we're their biggest and most stable customer. And China is primarily about business. And it sounds very strange for a communist country to be primarily about business. But the way they sustain their population's relative well-being, and that's critical in China, because the government certainly is desperately afraid of its own people, which is why they put such clampdowns on them and are afraid of democracy. And because of that, they keep their people happy just as the Saudis do by keeping them economically relatively well off. And as long as the perception of growth and the perception of I'm going to be better off in the future than I am today with the current situation, then they have a stable government, and they are working very hard to maintain that. Now, if you look at the balance of trade we have with China, for instance, most of the components in an iPhone, if you own an iPhone, are made in China. Matter of fact, whatever electronic device you have or whatever you go to buy in the store, that you will look at it and discover relatively quickly that it's made in China. For example, and I think this is one of the greatest ironies I've heard recently, a member of our staff was going to visit China, and she had her husband was already over there on business, and he asked her to bring some memorabilia with her to give to the Chinese as gifts from Texas A&M, where he is a student, and he's over there as part of his graduate work from Texas A&M. So she went around to all the Texas A&M gift shops, and all of the anything that sold Texas A&M anything in the area around College Station, and to her chagrin, she discovered that anything that she bought that was Texas A&M, the heart and soul, many will tell you, of Texas, had a little tag on it that said made in China. That tells you a universe about how the world economy works. We simply don't have anybody in the United States that's willing to make that stuff. The Chinese make it very efficiently, very quickly, and very inexpensively, and they get it back over here, and the businesses that sell it, including Texas A&M University, can make a profit on it when they sell it to people who want to buy Texas A&M memorabilia because it is inexpensive to make. And you say, well, and the Trump and other people have said, well, yeah, but all those jobs have gone to China. The fact is that we just had a low hiring rate of 38,000 at the last report. And a lot of analysis has gone into that relatively low number because people were expecting 160,000 people net to be hired. In other words, 160,000 more people hired than laid off. We had low layoffs, too. As a matter of fact, the hiring rate, even the 38,000, was largely because we had extremely low layoffs. But here's the issue with the low hiring rate. The number of job openings to people looking for work is up near a record high right now. In other words, there are about 5 job openings in the United States for every person in the United States that's seriously looking for a job. So why was the hiring rate low? Well, there's a couple of reasons, but the primary reason is because we don't have enough qualified employees in the United States to fill the jobs that employers would like to fill. We have 4.7% of the people in the United States actively looking for a job and not able, or in the recent past have been unable to find a job. Now, people can talk about the fact that there's people with part-time jobs and there's all kinds of other numbers that are floating around. Frankly, those numbers are there. They've always been there. They can't be used effectively for analysis because we didn't track them until quite recently. It was only in the 1990s that we started tracking the underemployed people. So we really can't look back at previous economic cycles and tell what went on. We can say, though, that 4.7% of the population looking for a job at any given moment and actively looking for a job at any given moment is something in the vicinity of what we call full employment. In other words, at any given moment in time, there's a certain number of people who've left their job because they want to move on, because they moved from one place to another, or because their spouse moved from one place to another. There's always, there's a certain number of people at any given moment in time who are between jobs. And that number tends to run, and in optimal conditions with full employment underway, somewhere between 4% and 5%. Well, we're at 4.7 right now. And there's a lot of discussion about, well, a lot of people have left the labor force, and there's a lot of back and forth on this. But still, the bottom line to it is we're pretty much at full employment in the United States. If you really want a job and you're willing to move to where the jobs are, you can find a job in the United States. It may not be your ideal job. It may not pay as much as you'd like it to pay for your skill level, but you can find a job. And in many cases, where you find the job, they'll be looking for two or three more people that they won't be able to find who are willing to work. So to say that we should bring the jobs back from China to make stuffed toys for Texas A&M, very frankly, there's nobody in the United States who's willing to make stuffed toys for A&M. There's no companies willing to try to manufacture them for Texas A&M. If they did, if we were to impose a tariff, what would happen is the Texas A&M toys would at least quadruple in price. We would stop buying them, and the businesses that sell them would go out of business because we simply wouldn't buy them at the price we would have to pay if they were made in the United States. Admittedly, Chinese workers work for next to nothing. And that's, you know, $5 a day is good pay there, because $5 a day, U.S. dollars, buys enough of whatever is necessary to buy that a person can make a living and support a family on $5 a day in China. That's just one of those awkward realities in the big, wide, real world. So the issue is really fairly simple. China's economy is dependent upon the United States. It's dependent upon selling to the United States. Its ability to buy raw materials to keep its industry going, even if it could sell to somebody else at the rate it sells to us, is dependent upon having a lot of dollars backing its currency. So when they go to buy raw materials in Africa, they've got dollars to pay for the raw materials. And we have another caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, while we're talking about this China thing, there was an article, I think, yesterday in the Wall Street Journal about China's on a shopping spree. There's like 20 big companies in Germany they're looking to buy.
Sure, and I can understand that.
This reminds me of, you know, when the Japanese were buying everything in the late 70s, early 80s, and then things cratered. Any parallels?
Oh, yes.
Japan did, and okay, if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
Sure, that's a very good observation. The Chinese companies and individuals are coming up with ever more creative ways to get their money out of China and to get it into something that's more stable. And when you have a balance of trade that's out of whack as much as China's is, or as Japanese did have, where tremendous amounts of dollars are pouring into China and they're exporting goods. And this has been going on for a long time. So they wind up with a lot of dollars. And this is why, by the way, I said that our trade imbalance, the balance of trade for the last 45 years or so has been horribly negative, and economists have been predicting the collapse of the United States economy, because you can't run a negative balance of trade for any length of time without having your economy collapse. Well, here we are, you know, 40 years later, running a negative balance of trade the entire time with the healthiest economy, the healthiest developed economy in the world. And that's without any question, this is the only economy in the world that's what's called a developed economy, a mature economy, where we're looking at when we're going to raise rates rather than worrying about how far into negative interest rates we need to go to keep the economy from sliding into depression. So here we are. You literally can't have a negative balance of trade for an extended period of time without something going wrong, because it constitutes a drain on the economy that has the negative balance of trade. So we were exporting something that's not being recorded, and what we were exporting is dollar. And normally we don't think of spending money as exporting money, but the fact is that the world currency, The one that's used, as I said, by China, which is the second largest economy in the world after the United States, the dollar is what they use as its as international exchange. And the rest of the world is doing pretty much the same thing right now. There's an article in the Temple paper today about how nobody is lined up to join the euro. Good idea, because a few years ago, everybody was trying across Europe. All of the members of the European Union, with the exception of a couple, were lined up to get as quickly as they could, not just into the European Union. Once they got into the European Union, they wanted to get on the euro. Well, it's interesting. The countries that have, there's still is a pretty good sized number of European Union countries that are not on the euro and don't want to be. There is a great deal of concern. It's one of the things that's holding the market down right now. That is, the British exit the European Union, even though they're not on the euro, it could negatively affect the euro. It could be the death knell of the currency. Now, I don't think it will. I think the euro is going to persist for quite a while. The euro is fundamentally an extended German Deutschmark. The German currency effectively dominates Europe. And it eventually will implode. I can tell you that with a great deal of confidence. I don't have a certainty on that. But I believe it eventually will implode, because they do not have, unless there's some kind of crisis where they have a constitution and fiscal control is ceded by the individual nations in Europe to the European central government. I actually don't think that's going to happen, because the European central government has proved itself exceptionally inept. Even more so than the United States government did before our Constitution. And since the fiercely independent French are very unlikely to give up their sovereignty, the Germans are unlikely to be willing to give up their sovereignty. Both of them are perfectly willing to give up their sovereignty as long as what they've done do is effectively just extend their sovereignty to the rest of Europe. So that if the rest of Europe were to effectively become under the control of Germany, Germany would be glad to have a constitution that covers all of Europe. The French, if they could write the constitution, and they did write the original constitution for the European Union, would love to have Europe adopt a constitution that gives France the total control. The French would love to take over Europe, which they've tried to do over the past several centuries, multiple times, so have the Germans. The British basically have backed out and said, you guys just have a lot of fun over there, and they may be leaving the party completely on June 24th. We don't know yet. The polls swing one way or the other, but polls are notoriously wrong in this day and age. So what we have is a world that is dominated by the dollar, that is led by the United States, and is going to stay that way. The Chinese, indeed, are trying to get money out of China because of the extreme controls. The government controls the economy and manipulates the economy in China. And that is good for the government, and it's probably good for the people of China. But if you're an individual investor in China, and you realize that corruption is endemic, sudden crackdowns by the government just appear out of nowhere, and it's entirely possible, as it is in Russia, that if you're too successful as a business person, you could suddenly find yourself in prison or dead. Local authorities in the Chinese Communist Party and in the government have been known to, routinely are called out for not only accepting but demanding protection bribes. So while the opportunity for investment in China by Chinese has been huge, and as a result we have a lot of billionaires who are Chinese, they are really uncomfortable about the stability of their wealth and their opportunities in China. But there are severe export controls on money leaving China. So one of the things one way to get around the export control, and the Chinese government supports this, is if a Chinese company purchases a foreign company. Now, the government of China is in favor of that because it raises their tax base, and in many cases, it enables them to gather intelligence that they would be otherwise unable to gather. And they're very much into that. And so they grant exemptions if you want to send the equivalent of a few billion dollars. By the way, when they buy these German companies, Chinese convert, they actually buy them with dollars converted in many cases to euros. Because you can't go to Germany and spend the Chinese currency to buy a company, but you can using dollars and euros. Those are both acceptable means of purchase. So what you have is a world where we dominate what's going on through our dollar, whether we like it or not. The Federal Reserve ultimately becomes the central bank of the world, and this is a growing issue. This is a growing trend, and I think we're just going to see a lot more of it as time goes by. It also has some potentially negative implications in that when people are very much afraid, and they are across particularly Europe right now, Europe is in deflation. We'll talk about that a little bit in a little bit. One of the reasons that both in Japan and in Europe, people have been able to make double-digit returns on bonds, long-term bonds, long-term government bonds, is because the economies of those nations are actually in deflation. In other words, they have negative inflation. If you hold a euro and you're in Germany or if you're in some country across Europe, you hold a euro for a year, you can buy more with it in a year than you can today. Significantly more in some cases. Is that good? Well, it could be. Unless you owed money. If you have a mortgage, for example, and I'll just use a round, rough figures that are a little exaggerated. Let's say you had a 1,000 euro payment a month on your mortgage. A year later, your wages may have gone down, and the amount of money you're getting has gone down. The interest that you get on your bonds that you may have bought has certainly dropped. As a matter of fact, in cases they're negative where you're paying the money, you're paying the government to buy their bonds. But your 1,000 euro mortgage stayed the same. And since the 1,000 is now a higher value than it was a year ago, your mortgage payment effectively is going up every year. And the bigger your debt that you have, the more it goes up every year. That is really, really, really awkward and results in people being unwilling to borrow money. And if you're not willing to borrow money, you're not going to buy major items. Businesses are not going to buy major pieces of equipment. They're not going to expand. People are not going to buy houses. And this causes unemployment to rise and stay high, which we're seeing all across much of Europe. European unemployment is running around 10% right now, and they seem to be pretty much unable to budget. The Eurozone, is running around 10%. They're unable to budget. One of the reasons they're unable to move this is because deflation is going on. And as long as deflation goes on, businesses are unwilling to expand. It's cheaper just to hang on to their money than to do anything else. So they hire fewer and fewer people. More and more people become unemployed. People become very unhappy, particularly minorities, and this creates a lot of problems like we saw in the Great Depression. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here remains 773-1400, area code 254-773-1400. We do have to do commercials because, very frankly, this is a commercial radio station. And somebody has got to pay KTEM and Town Square Media so it can stay on the air. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach and Jeff McClure. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure on this Saturday, June 11th, 2016. Telephone number in here, 773-1400. The area code is, of course, 254. First thing I need to say is the commercials you just listened to are not chosen by the Personal Wealth Coach, nor do we endorse in any way what the, if you were listening, if you're online, you obviously didn't hear the commercials, but they're illustrative of some things that are going on. Three of them were about wonderful investment opportunities that people are wanting other people to take on. And one of them was how to get out of debt if you're over your head in debt. And it tells you a lot about what's going on. I don't know anything specific about the particular offerings that are going on out there. But I can tell you they're very symptomatic of this very low investment return economy that we're in. And there's no easy solution to it. Anytime that somebody wants to advertise publicly for a wonderful investment opportunity, the question that I suggest you ask is, why are they spending money advertising for other people to do it rather than just doing it themselves? If it's a wonderful investment opportunity, then they should do it themselves. For example, major real estate companies have made a lot of money buying real estate and selling it, buying real estate and making income off of it. If the opportunities are there, then the people with money will certainly jump on the opportunities and they will take advantage of them and become well off doing them. On the other hand, there are a group of people, they're always around, who want to get you to give them money for a wonderful investment opportunity that's going to make you wealthy, that's going to turn you into a millionaire or whatever. I suppose it could turn you into a Donald Trump. The question that's really important to ask is, why are they eager to have you give them their money, your money, or use your money to do something that's going to make you wealthy if they could do it themselves and spend the money on doing it rather than trying to sell it to you? It's a very, very important issue, and it has to do with stocks and bonds and annuities and real estate. Factually, there is a way to make money on houses in any given community at any given moment in real estate. Barring some depression caused by the departure of a major employer in the area, it is possible to take time, have money available, go to the auctions that are held in each county each month, where houses have been foreclosed on for taxes or for mortgage non-payment. They publish a list in advance. You can go around and look at them. You make a bid. You need to have money. Here's one of the big issues. You need to have money available to buy those houses. And if you buy them and they're in pretty bad shape, but they're in a reasonable neighborhood, and you're willing to go in and invest the money to fix them up and bring them into good condition, in other words, you have improved the utility of that house. You can bring, and a lot of people have put a lot of sweat equity into that I've known over the years, who have made they have made good money. Now, there's a lot of work involved, and there's a certain amount of risk involved because their money's tied up in the house, and the economy or the local or whatever, something could turn around in a short period of time. Or it could be that they buy the house and then later realize it's infested with termites and they have to spend a lot more money fixing it up than they thought they were going to spend fixing it up. But the bottom line to it is, if you're careful and if you know what you're doing and you're willing to put a lot of time into it and you're willing to make some mistakes and lose some money, buying houses that nobody wants, spending the time, money, and energy to bring them up to a good condition and then reselling them a year later or renting them out can be profitable. If you have to borrow money to do all of those things, you're going to run into some problems at some point. And I thought there was a certain irony in that the advertisements for business opportunities, which I suspect have a lot to do with borrowing money, and sometimes being less than completely honest in how you borrow the money. And So you had these business opportunity advertisements followed by a, if you're over your head in debt, here's how we can help get you out. They go together pretty well. Unfortunately, there are ways to make money, and they really boil down to you can invest. You can invest carefully. You can invest with your eyes open, having carefully analyzed what you're doing, or else hire a fiduciary professional to do it for you. And I don't mean a salesperson. And so-called financial advisors are salespersons. Or you can do it yourself. You can start a business. The issue is that if you have a job and you're working full-time and you don't know anything about a subject, if you think you can go out there and throw some money at it and quickly make money without risk, odds are you're in for a very unpleasant surprise. There's just not a reality to that. I've run across a lot of people who are about to make a lot of money in these things, but so far, and admittedly, I've only been doing this now for about 35 years, I have yet to find one who really made all that much money. In most cases, when we did a cash flow analysis, they were feeding their investments, and they were gradually, in many cases, and I don't know, this is 100% true, and I don't know in this particular case, the advertisements that were on a few minutes ago, if it's true there, but they wound up emptying out their investments and their savings over a period of time, chasing money, chasing wealth, chasing richness. And at the end, they wound up far less well off than when they started. And that's just a general truth. You have to open your eyes and approach any of these things with a lot of investigation and a lot of skepticism. And so far, the get-rich-quick, wealth without risk, the economy is stupid and you're smarter method of trying to make money is universally, in my experience, and admittedly, I've only been at this 35 years now, but before that I was an observer and investor. So I've got about 45 years under my belt in that area, and I have yet to see anyone who has become wealthy doing these things. And if somebody's listening out there who has been flipping houses and become wealthy doing it, or if you know of somebody, sure, give me a call and tell me about it. I'd love to hear it. I have been looking for that person for 3.5 decades now and have yet to find that person. We're about out of time for this hour. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure. But we'll be back after after Fox News on the other side on this Saturday, June 11th, with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'll be talking a little more about the general economy, specifically about some things that are going on in the United States economy right now and in the world economy that are pretty practical and I think will have a significant effect on a lot of people. I published a newsletter again, or we did yesterday, and I declared a bubble. Now we'll see if I'm right, but I'll give the argument to support that or not support it. Personal Wealth Coach is not only a radio program, which you're hearing if you're listening, and if you're not, that's okay. It's also the name of an investment advisory firm. We're registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission, and that just basically means we have over $100 million under management. And it's in Salado, and the telephone number down there is 947-1111, or you can call 800-914-7526. It's 800-914-PLAN. We have voicemail during the weekend and live people answering the phone all week. You can send me an email at jeff@tpwc.com or jeff@thepersonalwealthcoach.com if you'd like to type out really long addresses. You can go to our website, www.tpwc.com,